космос. Последний рубеж. Это путешествие подкаста The Big Bird Theory. Его миссия – каждый четверг делиться новостями науки и вместе с вами открывать новые горизонты знаний. Смело идти там, где еще не ступала нога человека.
Бордатого времени суток, дорогие друзья, вы слушаете 241 выпуск подкаста «Теория большой бороды» самого научно-космического русскоязычного аудиошоу. Меня зовут Антон Поздняков, и сегодня у нас большое переводное интервью с Мэтсом Вилсоном из Копенгагенса Borbitals. Мы с ним познакомились на конференции New Space Days, которая проходила в Минске, совсем недавно я там был, и мне кажется, мы очень продуктивно провели почти час времени. Это было такое достаточно большое интервью, собственно, вы его сейчас и услышите. Там мы подробно поговорили о том, что они за компания, какие цели они преследуют, как они это делают, и, как по мне, получилось очень интересно. Так что на этом, я думаю, вступительную часть можно заканчивать. Да, важно отметить, что это оригинальная версия на английском языке. Если вам нужен перевод, то пройдите в соседний подкаст, он в вашем подкаст-приемнике, либо же на сайте, так и помечен, как русская версия с переводом. Так что вот переходите ее слушайте, если она вам больше подходит. А мы переходим, собственно, к интервью.
Okay. So today I am joined by a very interesting guy from a very interesting company, which I think you will find very entertaining to listen about. So today I'm joined by Mads Wilson from Copenhagen Suborbitals, and basically they are a team of enthusiasts who have a very ambitious goal to be the first amateur team to put a human being into space on their own rocket. I would say that's pretty ambitious, but let's hear what you have about to say. So, hello, Mads.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and so I think we should talk about this project because we're a podcast about space. So let's talk about it in stages. So yeah. The first stage, I would say, is the idea that you have. So tell me more about it. How you got to it? What's the overall goal, and why do you have this goal, and how did you come to that?
Yeah, it all started about a little more than 10 years ago, where a couple of guys in Copenhagen got together with this crazy idea that maybe it was possible to build a rocket that could put a human in space, and the first and original idea was to not overcomplicate it, but to see how simple can we build a rocket? Can we literally build a rocket out of pretty much a scrap and spare parts and what we can find that is powerful and accurate enough to send a person over the Kármán line? And that project back then sort of just grew. They had a blog on a local Danish media that very quickly got a lot of followers. And then at one point in time, they were complaining that they didn't have any more money. They were working out of a very, very small workshop on a barge. Actually, it was on an artist's collective called Ilotron in Copenhagen. And they didn't have any money for rent, or they didn't have any money for materials or anything. And then this support group started to grow, where a lot of people got together and said, "Hey, we can raise money. We can help you. I'm willing to pay 100 Danish kroner every month as my contribution to the work that you are doing." And then that was sort of the kickstart of everything, because from then the project grew very fast. It was not only people who donated money, but also all sorts of specialists from Denmark, people who were interested in this project and had specialities in electronics or IT or welding or mechanical engineering or whatever. They started to appear and to say to these two guys, "Hey, I can do this. I can join in. Can I help with this?" And then all of a sudden, a few years later, the project was more than 50 people, and we have pretty much kept it that size. 50 people that were working, and with a follower and supporting base of almost 1,000 people contributing every day. And the idea of everything has always been to build something as simple as possible. Not something that is very complex, but just good enough to build a rocket that can safely put a human in space.
And so you had this goal for a while, you said, for started almost 10 years ago. Have you ever thought of, okay, if you succeed with this goal, what other possibilities there will be for the rocket? Maybe there are some other uses that you're considering. Or also, let's imagine a situation where you've successfully put a human into space. Is there anything beyond that that you're doing, or you know, maybe you haven't thought about it yet?
Of course, we have thought about it. We talk about it sometimes. But one of the things that has been interesting for most of us during this project is that we have discovered that, yes, you can build a rocket quite easily. It's fairly simple to build a hybrid rocket, for example. But to build a rocket that is stable and reliable, that is quite tricky. If you guys who are listening to this afterwards go into our YouTube channel and watch some of our older videos, you can see that we have had some spectacular failures. And also, just because you see a video where a rocket is launching and everything looks good, it doesn't mean that that experiment was a huge success in terms of having a human being survive the trip. So we haven't really gotten to that point yet where we are thinking about what's next, because we have discovered on the way that even though you can do a lot, this is not as easy as it looks. And even though there are solutions that are very promising, simplistically or what you can say, then there are reasons why nobody has done this before. But that being said, we have, over the past 10 years, developed a lot of technology, and we have come very far. And I'm actually confident now that our next project, the Speaker rocket, that will be the rocket that will put a man above the Kármán line.
Yeah, and I assume that, well, I think, first of all, it's important to mention that, you know, I think some people might misread it. So you're not trying to put a human into orbit. You're just trying to go beyond the Kármán line, which is 100 kilometers up, which is the formal border of space. But it doesn't mean that it is simple in any way. I assume that just lots of people are used to see that, you know, if a human being is launched into space, usually they go to the ISS, which is in the low Earth orbit. But you're doing something more similar to what I think Blue Origin is trying to do right now. And by the way, does this these initiatives, not only by Blue Origin, but basically space tourism companies that try to put they I think will do it fairly soon, they are also putting people formally into space, so above the Kármán line but not in the orbit, so does it affect your ambitions in any way, or are you still focusing, okay, we're just trying to build it ourselves, we're trying to stay, you know, in the amateur line, so it's not a commercial project or anything? So does it affect your motivation or your goals in any way?
Yeah, that a lot of different questions in that.
Let's focus on the last one. Does the space tourism thing affect your goals in any way?
Yeah, actually, I would like to just briefly address the first one, because I think it's important for the general understanding. I mean, most people, even though they are working in the technical industry or have are technical professionals, are not physicists. When we, for example, look at what SpaceX has been doing recently, where they are launching rockets and landing them again, they have set a whole new standard for what is possible. But from a physics point of view, every time I see one of SpaceX's rockets land, my head just explodes, because we are working with rocketry every day, and I know, in terms of just ordinary physics, how incredibly advanced and how incredibly difficult it is to do what they are doing. And that being said, my point in this is building a rocket as we are building it to go just above the Kármán line, or I mean just even to go 50 kilometers up, to take the step from that and to putting something in orbit, that step is huge. It's not just building the rocket a little bit bigger, because they are a whole, it's a whole new ball game. There are a lot of other things you need to worry about, and you need a lot more power to produce the speed that would enable your rocket to go into orbit. What we are doing is sort of a lightweight version of the first American astronaut in space, for example. The Alan Shepard, he rode on a modified Redstone missile that was basically the Mark II or III of the German V2 rocket. But what SpaceX and what Blue Origin is doing is so much more complicated. If we put SpaceX aside for a minute, because they are a whole different ballgame, and look at Blue Origin, what they're doing is they're putting a lot of money into building rockets that can put humans above the Kármán line and create a tourist experience. And if you look at drawings, size comparisons of their rocket and our rocket, it's their rocket, of course, is maybe 5 times bigger or something, but it's not, they are not that big when you compare them to, for example, the Falcon rockets, the Falcon Heavy, or the SpaceX's new spaceship. But I don't think that it will threaten our ambition or our drive in any way, because we are not trying to create space tourism. We're not trying to build something where people can buy a ticket and be put into space. That's not the goal. Our goal is not so much really the end result, but more the journey. We want to show that it can be done. We want to show that ordinary people without much money, just by sheer talent and will, can build a rocket that can put a man in space, or that can put a man above the Kármán line. So the end result, I mean, it will be a sad day for me, the day where we actually accomplish our goal, because that means that the journey has ended. I don't think that we as a group will have the financial capability to build something that can go into orbit, because that what we're doing now is already a huge thing, and putting something into orbit, for example, will multiply that by 10. But the journey is extremely important, and the fact that we are inspiring so many people around the world with what we're doing is also very, very important to us.
Yeah, and I just realized that if you successfully put a human into space, this will be the first European rocket to put a human into space, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, none of the Europeans ever put it. Everything went either from the US or from Russia or the former USSR or from China, and I think none of the rockets have ever put anybody into space.
No, that's
so that would be an interesting. Yeah, an interesting option, because I actually haven't thought of it as a European project that will be the first. And it's amazing that after all these years of basically human spaceflight, there were no European rockets that done it.
No, and also so, we are doing this in a completely different way, and we are doing it on a completely different budget. One guy once said to me that our entire yearly budget would be comparable to what one of the NASA centers spent on coffee or paper clips every year.
Well, that's a lot of paper clips, you know.
they are big centers. They have a lot of people. But I think it's interesting to when you look at it that way.
Yeah, yeah, and it's quite amazing that what you do. Let's go to the next stage. So we've talked about the idea, but can you tell me more about the team right now and how you're working? So because technically you can call it that you're building a rocket in a shed or something like that, because you basically have a facility that's not created for these purposes, but somehow you still manage to do that. So tell me a bit more about the working conditions and the team that you have at the moment.
Yes, we are working out of a workshop in Copenhagen, and that workshop is actually a shed, you could call that. It's a steel workshop that was originally built as a part of the Burmester & Wein shipyard in Copenhagen. And the shed is one of four sheds that they used to use for painting parts when they were building ships, and that the shipyard was closed down almost 20 years ago, so it hasn't been used for that since. But we have then moved in and transformed that old paint shed into a workshop, and it is not at all as good as we could hope. We have no heat, for example. So during the winter, when it's below zero outside, yeah, then it's also below zero inside the workshop. And all the machines that we have are old machines that we have got donated from closed down workshops or schools or something like that, or something that we have found and repaired ourselves or built ourselves. The latest innovation we have done is that the guys have built a CNC plasma cutter that we are using to cut out all the materials we need for the rocket. And that is something, it has been long underway, but this is something that can make our work go a lot faster, because we can produce all the critical machine parts ourselves without having to buying them from a laser cutter, for example. We are still about 50 people. All in all, I would say that the core team is maybe 20 or 25 people. There's also a lot of people attached to the project that are very specialized that we don't use that often. We have some antenna specialists, for example, that they mostly work in the months up to a launch, and then they are not that involved in the period from launch to launch. And then we have a lot of other people that are working almost every day in some part. But the problem is always that we are a volunteer project, which means that all the people working on the project, they also have a day job. They have to survive. They have to make their money somewhere else. So we only have the time we have in our spare time to do this, and this slows down the project, of course, because we cannot always move as fast as we want to, because people have to make money.
So pretty much everybody works somewhere else, right? So they treat this whole project as a hobby, and they have a full-time job, or at least a part-time job.
Yes, that's true. Full-time or part-time. Some like me are self-employed, you know, like consultants. So we can juggle around our time so that it works. But most people have a ordinary day job and can only work in the weekends or in the evenings.
Yeah, and so what sort of specifications for people do you have? So how many different jobs inside your project do you have? So are there people, you know, building engines, building the rocket itself, the housings and stuff like that? So how do you separate people into different jobs within the project?
In general, a lot of the people we have is people who are capable of doing many different things. One skill that is the most important for us is that you need to be able to not be extremely specialized, but you need to be able to do different things, or at least learn different things. We have a lot of engineers. We have a lot of electronic engineers. We have a lot of mechanical engineers. We have a kindergarten teacher. We also have people who don't have any formal education, but are self-taught in different ways, but are just skilled with their hands. But what we actually, what we really, really need is people who have good craftsman skills, metal workers, welders, people who can get an idea and then make it work afterwards.
Can actually build stuff, right?
Yes. People who are able to not just draw things on a computer or a piece of paper, but can actually also operate a machine and build it afterwards. And because when you have that skill, then you also have a different way of looking at designing things. Because a lot of people who are designing, who are just sitting behind a computer and drawing in SolidWorks or whatever, I mean, when you do 3D modeling on a computer, everything can be done. But when you have to produce it afterwards, you always have to think, okay, what I'm drawing here, how can this be made? And sometimes, well, not
and
even sometimes.
You also need to think about how to make it cheaply, right? Because
yes, and that was my next point, because not only can this be made, but also we have these three machines or we have these options to build it. How can I design something that can be produced using those machines and cheaply? I mean, if you design something that to put into a 3D printer where you can just push the print button and then whatever you need comes out, then it's easy. But the problem is that 3D printing, metal 3D printing is very, very expensive. I know that the industry is talking about 3D printing as this new holy grail where you can do everything very cheap, and that is also correct when you are defining cheap as compared to the normal budgets of the aerospace industry. But when you are looking at our budget, then 3D printing in metal is actually very, very expensive.
Yeah, and it's a whole new challenge to not only think about what do you need to build, but also consider the tools that you have and just using those tools, because it's a bit like the analogy that I'm thinking of is the Apollo 13 flight, where they had to build when they had this failure, and it's featured in the movie I think very well, when they had to work out a solution based on just things they have. And it was much more complicated than just designing something that you can build with a sophisticated machine and just, you know, put into production and spend a lot of money on that, but you're getting the solution. So you have to work with what you have, and that's it. Which I think is incredibly, incredibly hard. And kudos for doing that. I mean, I can't think of, you know, how can you do that stuff. And how much knowledge did you have before people entered your project, and how this turned out to be once people got into it? So for example, did you have any people who are somehow connected to space industry, so for example, who know how to build engines or how to build models that can be fairly easily tested aerodynamically or stuff like that? So how much knowledge do you have in the people before they came to Copenhagen Support Orbitals?
Yes, we have people attached who have a very, very good theoretical background in designing rocket engines. But designing engines and building them and testing them are two very different things. So much of the knowledge, the practical knowledge we have, is something that we have learned on the way. And what we also have done, and this is very important, is we have been looking a lot at what has been done already, because the technology we are using, that we are relying on for our engines, is the simple way of building a rocket engine. We are not aiming to build a super efficient 350 bar chamber pressure closed cycle methane engine like some of the professionals are doing, because that makes sense because an engine like that is very, very, very efficient, and you know can give you those extra 30% of thrust compared to the weight. For those of you listening who doesn't know that, in rocketry, weight is everything. It's all about getting as much power out of as little metal as you possibly can, so that you can keep the rocket as light as possible. But that is also, that is a curve that is not linear. At some point in that curve, things just, I mean, the difficulty of building things and designing things starts to raise exponentially, but the benefit doesn't rise that much. We are not trying to do that. We are trying to build something that is simple, good enough, reliable, and easy and cheap to build. So what we have done is we have looked a lot at the old designs from the 40s and 50s and 60s, all the old Soviet missile designs, the American missile designs, the German V2 engine, the early rocket designs from the 50s and 60s. We have been looking at a lot of that, and a lot of that is declassified. You can find the overall schematics on the internet. I mean, on NASA's webpage, you can find almost everything from back then. You can go to museums and look at both American, Soviet, Russian, German, whatever, old rockets, and then you can get a feel on how were they built. And once you have studied this for a while, and once you know about the problems, then it's actually quite fun to go and see this. If you go to a museum to see this rocket engine you haven't seen before, and then you can very easily say, oh, that's interesting, because I can see that this problem I know they have solved it this way. And especially
because you know what to look for, right?
Yes. And I'm especially fascinated by some of the old Russian and Soviet designs from the 50s and 60s, because you can clearly see on them that they were designing things the same way. They were designing things to be simple, easy to build, and reproducible, but not that effective. The effectiveness was not that important. It was more important that they could be built easily and reliably.
Okay, and so let's then go to the next stage. And can you tell me a bit more details about your journey so far? So what have you already built? What have you tested? And so basically, where are you going next in terms of rockets, engines, and stuff like that?
We have a few tracks. We started in the beginning 10 years ago. We started with hybrid rockets because we had this idea that hybrid rockets was the easiest way to reach our goal. And that is because hybrid rockets are quite easy to build. For those of you who don't know what a hybrid rocket is, hybrid means that you have a solid propellant that is typically a type of rubber or paraffin, for example, something that can be casted and then that in itself is not easily combustible. We used a form of rubber that could be casted into the shell of the rocket itself, and then you have an oxidizer that you pour into the casted propellant that could be, for example, nitrous oxide or liquid oxygen, and then when you introduce this powerful oxidizer to the rubber and you set it on fire, then you have a rocket engine. So that's quite simple to build, and it's easy to store because it's basically just like transporting a huge pile of car tires. It is not it's not dangerous in any way. But we found out during the testing, we have tested, as far as I remember, 3 rockets with this technology. The Heat 1X, the big rocket, the biggest rocket we have launched to date, and the Sapphire. Oh yeah, there was one more also called Smaragd, and then a launch escape system. So there was four rockets with this technology. But for all of them, we found that that the hybrids were very difficult to control, especially when you go up into in large size rockets. So when you look at the HEAT-1X flight, for example, you can see it flies and it looks good, but when you look at the data afterwards, that flight was just horrible in terms of launching a human. We had huge oscillation problems where the engine would go like whoop, 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 producing a pogo stick effect up in the rocket that would have killed the astronaut just from the oscillations. We tried to build the first rocket as a passively stable rocket, which also turns out to be very difficult in terms of launching an astronaut, because the only way you can have a real passively stable rocket is if it flies really fast, has a really high acceleration. And that is also something that doesn't really work for an astronaut. That would simply kill him. So after that, we turned to look at active guidance. The first actively guided rocket we did was the Sapphire, and that was a hybrid. And that flight was mostly to test our guidance system. And after that, we were supposed to launch a rocket called HEAT-2X. And all you guys listening, you can also look at our YouTube channel to see what happened to that, because the HEAT-2X was a classic example of overconfidence. We thought that we had everything under control, that we could build everything. And then we did a test burn of the entire rocket on the platform. And the engine just collapsed and destroyed the whole rocket, so we had to start all over. And then what we did after was what we built the Nexus class rockets, which is the latest rockets. The last one flew last year. And those are biliquids, liquid oxygen and ethanol. And all the control systems in the rockets are the same as the ones that we will be using in the big rocket. We have flown two of them, and the Nexus 2 was the first rocket that we have built that actually flew the way it was supposed to. So with the results we got from that rocket, we are right now building the first prototype of the Speaker rocket that will be 1 meter in diameter and about 14 to 15 meters tall. So that's quite a big rocket.
Yeah, so the Speaker rocket is the future, and even though you say it's a big rocket, I think that you've mentioned that it's actually very small in terms of a rocket that can put a human into space.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's as small as possible, basically, is to fit a human in a capsule that will sit on top of the rocket, right?
It's about half or one third of the size of the rocket that put the first American in space, the Redstone rocket. So it's quite small.
Yeah, and I think you've mentioned when we were in the conference, you've mentioned that you're using the diameter of the rocket that's slightly less than 1 meter, because you can source the pipes of this. Of basically this diameter, right? So that's another example of how you can adjust your engineering based on like what you can get.
Yes, it's because the reason why we have chosen that diameter is because you can get end caps for tanks and some parts of the tubing, you can get that in that diameter, and that's why we have chosen that diameter, because then we don't have to produce very special equipment.
So does this mean that the rocket will be partially built from parts of the hardware store, so we can basically go to the hardware store, buy some tubings, pipes, and
like the diameter? Yes, for example the end caps for the pressure tanks, I know that they have just arrived in the workshop a few weeks ago. They are just standard end caps that you would use for any industrial tank. There's a company in Denmark who produces them, and you can buy them just right off the shelf. The tank sides, we will be making them ourselves from rolled sheet metal welded together. But a lot of the other components, like valves and stuff, they are not space rated at all. Those are just standard industrial components. A good example is, for example, we use for most of our pipework in our rockets, we use a component called dairy clamp, which are these small conical clamps with a little rubber seal, and then you have a ring to tighten them with. And that is components that are normally used to connect tanks and pipework in dairies or breweries or other parts of the food industry. And they are very, very reliable. They are very accessible. You can get them in any size, and they are quite cheap and they're very good. And we're using them for all the pipework in our runners.
And how do they withstand low temperatures? Because one of the things that exists in basically rocketry that doesn't usually occur in other industries such as food industry or plumbing or whatever is dealing with extremely cold liquids like liquid nitrogen and liquid oxygen and stuff like that. So how do these pipes withstand that, and did you need to make any adjustments based on that so to make sure that the system supports cryogenic temperatures?
We don't have that much problem with the tubes and connections, not related to cold temperature. The biggest challenge is that you need to remember that when you are putting, when you are applying a super cold liquid to a metal tube, then the metal tube contracts quite considerably. So you need to have flexible couplings at different places, because otherwise the tube can simply break just because it's contracting. We are talking about several centimeters, but the couplings themselves isn't really a big problem. Stainless steel works fine at low temperatures. The biggest problem we have with the low temperatures are the valves. Because
well, the seals. Just sorry to interrupt, but the reason I'm asking that is maybe quite disturbing. But I think that problems like that weren't considered back in the time. So the O-rings and rubber O-rings that didn't withstand the temperature really well was the problem with the Challenger disaster. So how do you test for that? Because if we're talking about putting a actual human on top of the rocket, you have to think about stuff like that. So
of course, and everything needs to be designed that way, so that the components we're using can withstand the correct temperatures. That's correct. But industrial components today are very, very good and very, very reliable, and you can buy seals, for example, that are designed so that they can withstand cryogenic temperatures. And of course, we do not use the same kind of seal for a low temperature joint that we will for a high temperature joint. But it's still something that you can buy just off the shelf, because there is a lot of use of cryogenic liquids in the industry also. So those parts exist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I was just asking if you consider that, because for me it's something that isn't obvious straight away, so you need to come to that. But it's good to know that you're accounting for that. And so let's talk a bit more about the before we come to the human capsule and stuff like that. So how the astronaut feel themselves in the actual capsule. So is that correct that basically all the stuff that you buy, all the machinery and stuff, so you basically use the crowdfunding money for that? And so if you had let's say if you had more crowdfunding money, so where would you allocate them? Would you buy better machinery, better materials, maybe hire somebody or so, something like that?
Yeah.
If you had a little more funds, how would you use them?
The biggest challenge we have is of course money. Well, actually the problem is not so much money, because the materials that we need is only a part of the problem, but it is both and also not money that is the biggest problem. The biggest problem is actually time. But as you know, money can buy you time, because if let's say let's look at it this way. We have some fixed expenses. We need to pay rent in the workshop. We need to buy materials. We need to buy supplies, you know, like welding gases and all the stuff, the consumables, discs for the angle grinder and plastic gloves and all those stuff that you use in the workshop every day. And then, we need to pay rent. And then we need to pay the harbor because we have some ships, and we need to buy materials to maintain the ships and all that. But that budget is fairly fixed. But if you compare that budget to what it would cost to employ 50 people, let's say that we were a company that were to employ 50 people, then our budget would be maybe not 50 times, but at least 30 or 40 times as high as it is now, because people are the most expensive thing. People's salary are the most expensive thing in a company. Right now, we don't have enough money. Every month we are struggling to make the money stretch. So if we had more money, and I really, really hope that more people from all over the world, also people listening to this blog, would like to contribute just a little bit. If we had more money, what we would spend those money on was to, of course, buy the things that we need to build the rocket, but it would also be maybe to get some more of the parts we need produced by someone else, because that is the best way we can buy time. So, for example, we can say, okay, we need this part machined. This would take us 40 or 50 hours in the workshop to do, but if we had the money, we could send it over to a machine shop and then have them do it, so that we can use our time on something else. So that is how we would spend the money. I remember at the conference where you and I met, we talked about this, and I have had the question many times if we would be interested, if a company came along and said, could we buy you, or could we put some money into your project? And the question there here is also both yes and no, because we want to be idealistic. We want to control this project ourselves. We don't want it to be a corporate project. But I would really hope that one day some guy, some philanthropist who has too much money on their hands, instead of buying a yacht or buying a football club or whatever, would come to us and say, hey guys, I think this is a really, really fun and really important project, because you are inspiring so many people around the world. So I'm willing to put in some money, even though I know that I will probably never get anything out of it, other than the fact that we are inspiring so many people all over the world.
Well, they can get the PR, right?
Of course they can do that.
Yeah, and that's fascinating. I mean, it's also, you know, it's also a bit unusual that you are not trying to make a lot of money, even if you had the possibility. So if you, what you're saying is that, so let's say if a big company comes and says, yeah, we were interested in your technology, can we buy your company and just employ all of you and make your project ours, that you would reject this offer. And that's pretty unusual, and that's really inspiring, to be honest, because you're doing that. But I think we have time just for one final question. I would like to talk about the actual human flight that you're planning. So basically, based on the details that you have about the capsule and about the rocket and about the actual ride, very uncomfortable would be a very nice way to say what the flight will look like. So can you tell me a bit more about the actual flight and how is it planned on the rocket?
Yes.
And what will the astronaut feel inside the capsule?
You are absolutely right that the flight will not be very comfortable. It won't. The capsule will be quite small. Again, all you listening, I would encourage you to go to our YouTube channel or to our website to look up the details. The speaker capsule will be very small. The astronaut will be sitting in a cannonball position, like curled together. We will be launching from a floating platform at sea. So he will be sitting there on top of a 15-meter rocket on a platform at sea, and you can imagine how much that would be shaking from one side to another in the summer heat. And then when the engine starts, he will accelerate from 0 to Mach 3.5 in 90 seconds. It is quite a lot of acceleration. It's not fatal, he might faint, but it's not fatal in any way, but it's quite a lot of acceleration. And then when the engine cuts off and the acceleration stops, you have reverse acceleration, at least from the astronaut's point of view. So he will then be kicked backwards in the seat once the acceleration stops. And then he will go another about 50 kilometers out towards the Kármán line, just by the inertia of the capsule. Then when he reaches the apogee, the capsule will be separated from the booster, and then the capsule will start tumbling, because just the forces from the springs that will release the capsule from the rocket will make the capsule tumbling. Because remember, we are now in a air-free environment, and he will experience weightlessness because he will be in free fall going down towards the Earth. And at that point, we need to straighten the capsule so that the heat shield is turning downwards. For that purpose, we will have a small RCS system with some small gas thrusters that will just go and straighten the capsule out. Then we will deploy a balut, a small parachute-like device, not designed to slow the capsule down, but just designed to straighten it so that we are sure that it's falling in the correct direction. And then the capsule will be falling, and then in about a height of 3 or 4 kilometers over the sea, the main parachutes will come out, and the capsule will then land in the water. And then the astronaut will be in the water. And you could imagine this is like lying in a small barrel in the water, just bobbing around without being able to do anything. It's very important that the parachutes are then detached, because otherwise the parachutes could drag the capsule under. And then the astronaut can only lie there and wait until one of our speedboats will pick him up. So it is not for people who are afraid of heights or afraid of being locked into small rooms.
Yeah, you have to be very, very brave and a bit crazy to go for it.
Yes, I usually say that you don't, because it will be computers controlling everything. So you don't need to have any special skill, but you need to be you need to have a very strong psyche to be able to cope with this.
Yeah, and honestly, I can't imagine anybody volunteering for that, because that's a very unpleasant journey, unless you really want to make history and be the first European guy to basically fly on a European rocket and the first amateur rocket. So I think that's the only motivation that you can get, but that sounds, as I said, not comfortable at all.
But actually, we have several people that have volunteered. Also people who from our group internally who knows what this is about and who knows how the journey will be.
Well, you can always say that they can say it for now, but when the flight actually comes, we'll see how many candidates will be left.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, I think we're closing to the time limit of today's episode, and I would encourage everybody who listens to that to follow the links in the description of the podcast to the Copenhagen Suborbitals website and their YouTube channel, where you can learn more about basically your fails and your successes you've had so far and your future plans. So anything else that probably our listeners need to visit, see, or, you know, maybe if they have any questions?
I think that if you're interested in space and if you're interested in what we are doing, just jump right in to our website and YouTube channel and watch out all our videos. There's loads of very fun and entertaining and informative material in there. And as you said, I also really hope that that there are people out there who find our work fascinating enough to be willing to spend a small amount of money each month and support us, because it is really all you people out there who make a difference. It's only because of you that we can do what we're doing.
Yeah, and maybe some of our listeners, because we have a lot of different listeners, might even want to join and help you with some, you know, engineering or maybe other jobs. So I think there might be somebody. So I think if you're in somewhere around Copenhagen or in other countries that are close, I think you can still make a difference. And if you want to work on a project like this, which sounds inspiring, even though being a little bit crazy, I think might be a great experience for you. So
yes,
if you're up for it, I can. You can basically contact the guys on their website. I assume that will be the best place to go, right?
Definitely, that will be the best place.
Okay, then thank you for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you and to know more about Copenhagen Suborbitals and your plans and ideas and how you do stuff. I hope that we've inspired a lot of people by that talk. And it is so I think the main idea that you show that it is really possible to get into space, not business, but, you know, to work with space, to get yourself into this whole thing fairly easy right now. And with the technology advancing, so if just, you know, 20, 30, 50 years ago, it was just, you know, the absolute top minds of humanity who were developing rockets and stuff like that. But now, ordinary people can do that. And it's actually probably easier than you think. And if you really want to go for it, You should do that. You should try. You know, you can either join the Copenhagen Suborbitals project, or maybe you can start your own little project, starting from just small rockets that, you know, building models, and then you can probably advance to something more serious. And Mads and yeah, the team are, I think, a very good inspiring example for that.
Definitely. I mean, so, you don't have to build a big rocket to learn. There's a lot of learning to be done just by building small rockets. So I would, if someone out there has a dream of doing this, I would encourage them to try just by building small rockets to begin with, or even small rocket engines, because you can really, really learn a lot. You just need to be,
yep,
you know, just need to be careful, because it's dangerous stuff.
Well, you can start from being water rocket and stuff like that, but I think there are lots of materials. So thank you for being on the show. Hopefully, you know, if we have enough questions, and I will be happy to invite you again. So if you have time, just
sure.
Don't hesitate to join again.
Что ж, вот таким получился 241 выпуск «Теории Большой Бороды». Надеюсь, вам понравилось это интервью. Слушали ли вы его в оригинале или в переведенной версии? Хочется анонсировать, что в следующем выпуске у нас также будет переводное интервью с гостем, я думаю, не сильно погрешу перед истиной, если скажу, что мирового масштаба. Если вы подписаны на Twitter собачка Бердифери, вы уже знаете, о ком идет речь. Если же нет, пусть для вас тогда будет сюрприз. Я прям очень горжусь тем, что у нас получилось записать это интервью, так что ждите уже следующего выпуска. В следующий четверг будет большое тоже переводное интервью, очень-очень важное. Ну а перед тем, как окончательно удалиться, мне остается только поблагодарить всех тех, кто поддерживает нас на платформе Patreon. Отдельно хотел бы поблагодарить всех тех слушателей, которые подписаны на Бердикаст Плюс, нашу максимальную подписку, которая дает доступ ко всему контенту, который мы публиковали и публикуем на платформе Patreon, а именно это слушатели Алексей Верхоланцев, Алексей Панфилов, Андрей Сгирятович, Богдан Пришедько, Владимир Владислав Михалев, Денис, Дмитрий, Дмитрий Хван, Дмитро Лапа, Евгений Кушнаренко, Иван Рубановский, Лев Фиц, Мишин Егор, Мэтью Малахов, Александр Чайковский, Александр Фищенко, Сергей Бондаренко, Виталий, Виктор Суриков, Владимир Агафонов и Владимир Ходаков. Также не забывайте, что вы можете очень просто поддержать наш проект, поставив ему соответствующее количество звездочек, а еще лучше написав отзыв в Apple Podcasts. На этом, я думаю, мы с вами можем окончательно прощаться. До следующего четверга, да пребудет с вами сила и пока-пока.